welcome to the Cycle Systems Academy podcast. I'm really thrilled this week to welcome back John Paul Ballard from Swisside. So, John Paul, thank you for joining us again.
Great to be here, Sean, and thanks for the invitation.
So, there's been quite a lot going on with Swisside since we spoke to you last, and I'm sure we'll have time to cover it all. But I was really fascinated by your pressure measurement rake, which has been publicized recently. Looks like it's technology from Formula One, if we look at, you know, videos online of Formula One cars and stuff. So do you want to give the listeners a bit of a background on the pressure measurement rake, where the ideas came from and what you've been applying it to?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea of a pressure measurement rake is nothing new. And as you say, it's another technology that we've conveniently stolen and brought across from Formula One, from our previous Formula One day experience. And where it's really useful, and let's say also particularly in the wind tunnel, is when we do measurements in the wind tunnel is kind of dumb in that sense. So you put a bike on a rider, for example, and you make a measurement and you find, let's say, 10 watts. Oh, wow, great. We've just reduced the drag from 10 watts. And, you know, maybe you've changed his suit or his position. And you go, okay, well, the 10 watts has come from that change. But you don't know the exact mechanism that's led to that change. So, for example, was it that the airflow is staying better attached on the rider's back? Or is it something to do with the legs? Or is it the head or the arm? Whatever. And so you're left just to interpret the result the best you can. And this is where pressure measurement rakes come into it. So first of all, to explain to everyone what a pressure measurement rake is, if you can measure the pressure lost or the energy lost in the airflow behind an object, that is the aerodynamic drag. So you start out with what we call 100% total pressure in the airflow. And as you take energy out of it, you have less and less total pressure. And when you actually can measure that, you can, first of all, you can also say even calculate a CDA based on the pressure lost. But really importantly, when you're then comparing two configurations, you can see where the difference is and where it's coming from. And that's basically what the pressure measurement rake systems that we use both in the wind tunnel but also out on the road, that's what they do.
Wow. So it's really taking it to the next level in terms of exactly what you're measuring and how. So you're not just seeing what's changing, but exactly why.
Exactly. And these sorts of rakes, I think, you know, anyone who's followed motorsport and in particular Formula One, they will have seen you know, these kind of rakes that literally look like grids of rakes that they build on behind the car, behind the diffuser, behind the front wheels very often. And a lot of this is for getting a clearer picture of what the losses, the wake that comes off these devices looks like, so that they can have a better correlation to their CFD development work. We do it for this reason as well. But actually for us, and in particular in the wind tunnel, it's mainly an understanding device. So we can really say, okay, we changed this rider's suit, we've gained 10 watts, and we know that that change has come because the airflow is remaining attached better on the arms, for example. So we really then understand from that measurement where the change is coming from. But what's actually quite different with this new rake that we've just introduced into the wind tunnel is what we've also tried to do is make aerodynamics or aerodynamic drag visual for our you know, the people who come with us in the wind tunnel, but also for those people who watch what we're doing online. And so what we did with the pressure measurement rake, rather than just having a system that makes a measurement that, of course, we can see in our computer, but what we also did was had a really fine pitch LED system on the front of this rake. And it changes color depending on the pressure that it's measuring. And then you can literally, in the wind tunnel during a run, live see these changes in aerodynamic drag. And what's been really interesting with the first feedback that we've had from customers who we bring into the wind tunnel is they can straight away see, oh, look where all the drag is coming from. It's coming, you know, down low, or it's coming really high. Or, oh, wow, I can see the helmet drag. And so we've achieved something that we've wanted to do in a long time, which is to make aerodynamic drag also visible and more understandable for our customers.
Wow. But, something I was going to get into later, but you just inspired me to ask this question now. Do you think the average rider, kind of no pro rider, if they saw that on their own riding position, do you think they'd be a bit horrified?
Yeah. Like, you know, basically when we do the scan, they can see the size of the hole they're punching in the air. And one of the things we quite commonly do, you know, say for a road cyclist, is we say, hey, ride on your upper bar position and now ride on the drops. And then we show the picture of what that aerodynamic drag looks like from the pressure measurement rake measurement. And they can just see the massive difference in the hole they're punching in the air. And of course, that then corresponds with the much lower CDA or aerodynamic drag level that we measure in the wind tunnel. And straight away, the rider, let's call it the customer, understands, oh, wow, that's where the aerodynamic drag is coming from. And I now understand why. And for us, what we're trying to do at SwissSide is very much bring our followers and our customers as well on an educational journey. So it's not just about making the best performing aerodynamics products. It's also about helping our customers and the users understand aerodynamics so that they can make their own judgment.
What I'm really interested in as well is who the customers are. So anyone who's listened to the previous podcast or maybe read about you elsewhere will know that SwissSide, you've got your own wheel brand. You do a lot of work designing frames for other bike companies, and you've done rider optimization for all sorts of really well-known riders in the triathlon world and the road world. So if you can say who is working with you at the moment in terms of bikes, in terms of equipment, in terms of rider optimization.
Yeah, I'm sure I could give a bit of an insight into that. So, you know, as you mentioned, the SwissSide business has kind of got three distinct arms nowadays. Like, there's the wheel business, there's the athlete optimization business, and like you say, there's the bike design, or let's call it equipment design business, which is mainly in the cycling industry. And we literally design or help brands now design everything from the head to the toe, or even the head to the tire, as far as aerodynamics go. So, you know, we're doing a lot of work on bicycle design. I think a lot of people have seen in the last last year the new Canyon Speedmax triathlon TT bike, as well as the new Aeroad. These are both bikes where SwissSide was involved and responsible for the aerodynamic development. So Canyon's a clear partner of ours. One bike that's a real game changer, which has been really fun and was a great project, is the recently launched Simplon Pride 2 road bike.
Mm-hmm.
We worked really closely together with Simplon on that one. And what was really interesting there is it's the first of the road bike designed around the new UCI rules, which gives you masses more freedom as far as aero goes. And we were able to really clearly show those benefits. And, you know, you can see it already. There are some independent wind tunnel tests that have been published by Rennrad Magazine, which is a German magazine, which shows, again, the size of the gains that we're talking about, which are anything but marginal.
Mm-hmm.
On the helmet front, we've been doing, you know, we've done projects for Rudy Project, the Wing TT helmet was a collaboration project with us, with Ekoi, which is a partner of a couple of our triathlon or triathlete sponsored athletes. They released in the Tour de France this year a new TT helmet, which has been a development collaboration with SwissSide. And probably the most exciting project for me personally was actually the racing wheelchair that we did for the Orthotech, the Swiss Paralympic team for this year, and in particular the Swiss Silver Bullets, Marcel Hug. And that was a project where we literally did, again, everything from helmet to suits to the wheelchair itself to wheels to even doing some tire work together with Schwalbe. So a really fantastic project. So yeah, we have our finger in the pie on many parts of the cake, so to speak.
And looking at there was a nice video year or so ago on cycling tips, and you got Patrick Langer and Laura Phillip using the pressure rake systems on their bikes. And it is quite a big thing, isn't it? It looks like a sci-fi film or something. But in terms of this as a product, do you think you'll have anything commercially available?
Yeah, short answer is no. Mm-hmm. So the main pressure rake system we use is in the wind tunnel. And that's really a wind tunnel specific system. And it's also specific to the wind tunnel which we use most often, where we are investing in terms of technology and equipment, which is the GST wind tunnel near Friedrichshafen in Germany. Of course, we do, and you've seen some images before, we do the on-bike systems, where we both have our CDA meter for measuring the aerodrag, but we also have as well the on-bike pressure rakes, and we have various versions of that behind the rider, behind the wheel. And again, this is actually more of a Swiss side specific research and development tool, because we really want to be anything but a marketing brand. We want to be a brand that's based around real performance, and that's why we also go around publishing the results of what we do, so that they can be challenged and tested independently by anybody. But part of that R&D process is we have to really make sure that what we measure on the road reflects what we measure in the wind tunnel. That also reflects what we simulate in the CFD in the computer when we do our aerodynamic development. So these rakes are really important for measuring those pressure fields on the road in the wind tunnel, and then we can compare directly with our CFD simulations to make sure that we've got a really good correlation. Because only by doing that do we actually have, can we actually ensure that our development process is meaningful and delivers real performance out on the road, which is in the end, the only place that matters.
Yeah. Well, talking of that, it's the Worlds in Flanders at the moment. And we had the women's race yesterday and the men's race the day before. And for a lot of cycling fans like myself who aren't absolute experts in aero tech, it was very striking how different the bikes are looking, even this year. But certainly if we look back at the past 3, 4, 5 years, the difference in time trial bikes and triathlon bikes is staggering. It looks like there's been a huge amount of change. So it looks like there's been quite a steep learning curve within, certainly the professional world tour world. So is there any involvement you've got there that you can talk about? And do you think that we are at an early stage or a late stage in that development?
Yeah, no, we have certainly been involved both in an equipment side, on a team side, and on an individual athlete side. And I completely agree with you in terms of we're seeing a big shift and a big change, that suddenly aerodynamics is actually being understood by, let's say, the teams and the teams and the athletes alike, and people are realizing that they need to do aerodynamic development if they want to be at the front. So it certainly has unleashed a bit of an aero boom as such. And I would say one of the most, apart from, let's say, quite a lot of new bikes, which we're seeing now, which are looking more and more developed, I'd say one specific region which we're seeing, which is genuinely delivers a lot of performance, are the cockpits, or what we call the cockpits, which is basically, the time trial bar setups, which are becoming more and more customized and aerodynamically optimized for the rider in their particular setup. We are seeing that, and that does bring a significant benefit and does lead to faster speeds and quicker times. I'd say you saw that, say, Team Sky was one of the early ones back in the day, obviously now Team Ineos, doing that, and you see that Filippo Ganna has been using one of these custom cockpit systems for a while now, and certainly a lot of these direct competitors have been following that trend. So we saw more and more of that, an athlete, specific athlete that we've been supporting more recently has been Marlene Reusser, who is the Swiss female athlete who was silver, who got silver medal yesterday.
Yeah.
I know she was a little bit disappointed. She was really hoping for gold, but you know, you can never know how things pan out in the day. We've certainly been involved on a few levels there, and it's been really interesting, as you say, to see the developments that have come through.
And looking at the Simplon bike, obviously there's a number of features that look, you know, familiar, you know, to bike fans and to designs they might have seen before. But is it the flow as a whole that's radically different? Can you tell us, if someone was looking at the Simplon bike, exactly what's really different about it? And also how you've integrated the best aerodynamics into things like handling and such as well? Because, of course, aero is part of the picture, isn't it, for a road bike?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing that you'll notice on the new Simplon Pride 2 bike is just the general, say, bulk of it. So with the new UCI rules, we're allowed to design a bike with the same, more or less the same freedoms that we have for a time trial bike. Mm. So we can use these so-called compensation triangles between each of the tubes, and you can effectively, by doing that, you can make the tubes longer. And in particular, an example is the head tube.
Yeah.
So, you know, gone are the days where you've got a simple round head tube where the fork goes through. You know, this is a big profile. And on the Simplon Pride, we really maximize the use of the head tube in the design. And it's a whopping 160 millimeters long. And that's a real sail. And, you know, we talk about this thing called sailing effect. And sailing effect is how we can use the wind to reduce the drag, and in some cases even produce some thrust, which is exactly what a sailing boat does through having, you know, its sail, and that's why it moves forwards. And we can have exactly the same effect in a bicycle with the design. And let's say one thing that's helped us a lot with maximizing the sailing effect is that these increased freedoms that we have on both the tube lengths. And as well, these compensation triangles between these tubes. So we have much bigger profiles on the bike overall. And what's very important is that what we do at Swisside is quite different to, let's say, what other bicycle designers have done in the past, in that the first go-to that bicycle designers do is they say, oh, we'll go and get a NACA profile. You know, and anyone who knows what a NACA profile is, it's an aircraft wing profile. That were developed, funnily enough, for aircraft. And typically most of these profiles were developed in the, you know, 50s and 60s. Now, one thing with an aircraft is an airplane travels a lot faster than we do on a bicycle. And you know, we like to say, well, you know, already say some of these NACA profiles are low-speed aerodynamic profiles. But what we do in cycling in terms of aerodynamics is ultra low speed aerodynamics, and profiles don't exist for this sort of speed. So we do extensive development in CFD, developing profiles that should function in the 30 kilometer an hour, 40 kilometer an hour ranges. And that's what makes a really big difference in what we do. And to the eye, you can't really see so well what this is, but the actual shape of the profiles and the individual tubes, and literally every single individual tube profile is optimized when we do a bike project. And I think that's sort of what stands out in what we do in a bike project.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognised cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.
Well, I can attest to that from my own riding, you know, not for it to sound like a sort of paid promotion, which it isn't, guys, you know, but I'm on the Swisside Hadron 625 wheels. And when I was first riding them, we were on Dartmoor in Devon, which is incredibly windy, much more windy than here in Switzerland. and there's lots of big gusts of winds. And like you said on the last podcast, these wheels just don't have this kind of rapid stall, you know, from the crosswinds where you really get pushed across the road. But if you looked at, say, another, you know, manufacturer's 50-60 mil deep wheels and the Hadron wheels, you wouldn't see the difference. You know, I can't tell how and why, but riding it, I can feel that. So as the road bikes and obviously time trial bikes get the deeper tubing, the compensation triangles for this sailing effect, are you also looking at ways to increase stability with that too?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think it's less so about increasing stability because contrary to what, you know, you read some things in the press, and for me as an aerodynamicist, sometimes it's a little bit frustrating. You know, most recently I read a certain wheel manufacturer write something like, oh, we maximize drag and minimize drag and we keep the handling good by minimizing the side force. Now, that's actually complete rubbish because unfortunately you cannot decouple sailing effect and side force. Because basically the more sailing effect we produce, the more thrust, or let's say the more lift we produce on the profile of the wheel, just like the profile of a wing, and that lift that we produce has quite a large component of side force. So you can't have good sailing effect without generating a lot of side force. And this is where we often come to our limits. So what we try and do is we always try and, say, keep the pressure, the lift that's generated, for example, by the wheel, as constant between the front and the back of the wheel as possible. And what this results is you end up with a minimized steering moment. So what you feel in your hands when the wheel loads up with increasing crosswind is you don't really feel it so much in your hands in terms of, like, you know, oh, it's loading more at the front than it is at the rear, which is causing the wheel to try and steer in a certain direction. And Sean, as you mentioned already before, it becomes particularly a problem when the wheel stalls, because then you get a sudden reduction in the side force that the wheel produces, and again you want to keep that as balanced as possible. So we've got to say, you know, these contradicting targets that we're trying to generate sailing effect, but at the same time we know we're generating a lot of side force, so we want to keep that, when it comes to a wheel, as balanced as possible around the steering axis. So when we go to bikes, we do have to apply a lot of the same thinking. Of course, when it comes to the fork, there are ways we can use the fork, although, you know, the profile of the fork is very close to the steering axis, so it doesn't have a huge effect on the steering moment that you feel in your hands and the handlebar. But what it does have is it has an effect on the front wheel and how the front wheel behaves with increasing crosswind angle. So what we try and do is we try and keep that into account, and we try and make sure, again, that this balance between the front and the rear part of the wheel always remains in sync, and the design of the fork has to consider that. Whereas the rest of the bike goes, what we typically try and do is set a maximum allowable side force for the bike, and we discuss that normally with the manufacturer, and we talk about what typical bikes have. And we normally do some benchmark wind tunnel tests with some competitor bikes, which they feel are good or bad as far as handling goes. And together with the specific bike brand, we come up with, you know, their own maximum side force target. And what we'll do is we'll develop the bike up to, but not over that maximum side force. And I think that's important because every brand then has kind of their own philosophy, and they can then inject that into the design of the bike. And then finally, as you already mentioned, is the stall characteristic. Now, certain profile designs stall really abruptly, and then sort of the cam tail, more cutoff profile designs can be a little bit more forgiving. And then again, depending what sorts of curvatures we use on the profiles itself, all has an influence. So what we always try and do is design bikes that maximize sailing effect, but then at the same time have a what we call a soft stall characteristics, which means that the profiles start to separate, not all together at the same angle, but then also kind of have as well like kind of a bit of a range of angles where they kind of start slowly give up, so to speak. And you end up then with a fairly benign feeling bike that uses the wind very effectively, and it's just very fast.
Well, we've certainly come a long way in, say, a decade, because I remember seeing the Felt AR, you know, which alongside Cervelo was one of the very first, you know, aero road bikes, and it looked futuristic for the time, and there were all these bold claims made about it. But the Garmin team, as they were at the time, all the riders were on the standard round tube bike, and we found that later it handled like an absolute dog. So it sounds like what we're getting is handling integrated with aero to take things up to quite a high, you know, standard. One of the things that I suppose is very different to F1 is if you're designing an F1 car, as you have done, did do for many years, you're in control of every single piece, aren't you? You know, you're not having to buy a group set for the F1 car. You can control every single thing. And with a bike, though, you can design the frame and the wheels and the cockpit, etc. But ultimately, someone's going to chuck on a SRAM Access group set or a Dura-Ace group set, if they can buy one, of course. So how do these things get taken into account when you're designing a whole system? And also, how are developments like electronic gears and disc brakes influence the aero development of your designs?
Yeah, really good question. So first of all, let's address the group set point. Luckily, the group sets themselves don't have any meaningful impact on the overall aerodynamics of the bike. So, you know, we do go in the wind tunnel, and, you know, specifically, like, for example, with a partner like Canyon, they also want to quantify, you know, what's the performance of the bikes with different group sets on boards. And it is actually really interesting that, you know, we'll build a bike, you know, with a SRAM setup, with a Shimano setup, sometimes even with a Campag setup, and to really see what the differences are. And what you'll end up with is just simply an offset in the drag level. So, you know, a certain group set might be a little more draggy than another one, but the overall characteristic of the bike remains unchanged. So that's good news in terms of, for us, developing bikes that we don't have to, you know, worry that they become very group set specific as such. But coming to things like, you know, electronic shifters and disc brakes, yeah, that is actually a really interesting one, because let's say they haven't been a step forward as far as aerodynamics goes. So I've mentioned in some of the talks I've done in the past, one of the most offending items on the bike, believe it or not, is the Shimano Di2 front derailleur. And it's the motor battery, or the battery, just the motor unit above the derailleur. And it's about 2.5 watts of drag, which for its at 45 kilometers an hour, for its size is a huge amount. And, you know, we always ask ourselves, you know, why they didn't make it more aerodynamic. And I think, you know, step by step, they've cottoned onto that with their new systems, and they're trying to make them more and more aerodynamic. But of course, the old mechanical systems were much more aerodynamic, apart from the fact that you then have the external cables. So, you know, you always had, you know, originally used to have the external cables. So, you know, there are always these, you know, these compromises which came up. But, you know, coming back to, and just quickly to mention, you've also got your one by system, which we're seeing this in time trial and in triathlon coming more and more, because you do win 2 to 3 watts when you do that. And that's, providing you still have a decent sort of set of gear ratios and not too big a steps between the gears that you want to use. It's a pretty good solution. We're seeing a lot more of the one by. Coming to your question about disc brakes, so that has been interesting, because that has given us more freedom for the aerodynamic development. So initially, disc brakes were a loss in terms of they brought more aerodynamic drag. To make that clear for most people, the reason for that is primarily the two things. One, the front wheel, you have a larger diameter hub. That's also given by the fact that you have to have a 12 millimeter through axle nowadays. So you end up with a larger diameter hub. And secondly, you end up with more spokes. So typically a minimum of 24 spokes compared to, let's say, a time trial wheel, which could have as little as 16 spokes or even less. And these things added to the drag together with the actual brake caliper itself. But where it does give us some more freedoms is then in the design of the wheels. So we have seen in recent times, and we're not the only brand to be doing it, the trend towards wider rims and wider inner rim widths. So we did a very big study together with our partner, DT Swiss, on this topic. And, you know, we investigated everything from our original 17 millimeter inner rim widths all the way up to 24. And what we actually discovered is that we found that the optimum was 20 millimeter inner rim width for, let's say, pure aero road wheels. And that's the basis on what we do now. But of course, these 20 millimeter inner rip rims, you couldn't get into standard brake calipers or rim brake brake calipers that were available on the market. So that's been something that's only been possible with the introduction of disc brakes. And we've been able to do a lot in terms of the profile development of the wheels, and in particular our latest model of wheels, not to plug our products, but I'll plug away the Hadron Squared the wheels. They generally have been a big step forward, particularly in handling. So we were able to reduce the steering moment, so this handling effect that you feel in the front wheel, by 23%, which is huge. And our wheels were already well known for their good handling because we specifically developed them like that. But with the additional freedom of the larger inner rim width, we were actually able to even achieve more by playing with the profiles and so on. So yeah, the disc brakes, originally a penalty, have led to now more aerodynamic bikes overall.
And I think one of the most obvious things for punters like me looking at, say, the bikes used in the world in the last couple of days is all the shifters now are these integrated buttons. Like Shimano's even making a bar with, you know, integrated DI2 buttons in the bar. You've not got these big clunky TT shifters sticking out and sticking up as you change gear.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, aerodynamic drag, you know, you can boil it down to, say, a couple of simple things, like, you know, first of all, frontal area. So, you know, the less of these big blobs that we put on the bike unnecessarily, the more aero it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And then, like you say, the more integrated they can be and the more sort of it flows into the form of the bike, you end up with less profile drag, so mm-hmm. the less drag that's generated by the shape itself. And both these things together make you faster.
And again, just a, you know, completely inspired question in this moment, but there's also been the Mountain Bike World Championships recently. And listeners to the pod, you'll have heard our podcast with Simon Burney from the UCI. And I've noticed watching the downhill that, just like you said on our last podcast, that downhillers were going to start getting into aero, the riders all looked to have much more aero clothing on. It looked like those downhill racers had been near a wind tunnel or at least worked with some sort of aero consultant. So is that something that's touched your work at all?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes. We've done a little bit of work in the mountain bike scene, but very little, and surprisingly little, because you know, it's not because a mountain bike runs through a forest and that looks cooler that means that aerodynamic, you know, is too cool to touch an air to touch a mountain bike. You know, in the end, it's an object moving through the air, and in the case of a downhill bike moving through the air very quickly. Yes, and, like, you know, one of my former work colleagues, Tony Salter, who's one of the chief aerodynamicists or principal aerodynamicists at McLaren, I actually saw him in the wind tunnel in the UK with some downhill mountain bikers. So I was, like, quite interested to see what he was up to there. You know, having a little bit of a dabble. He's also a big downhill mountain biker himself, so he's obviously having a play in a passion of his own. But the answer is yes, it makes a big difference. And, you know, originally, I think there was a phase where downhill mountain bikers started to wear Lycra, and, you know, they didn't like that because that was very uncool. So they were forced to wear baggy clothes again. But it's been very interesting, exactly like you say, to watch these clothes getting less and less baggy and more form-fitting, quite simply because it makes a difference on the stopwatch.
Yeah, it is. Again, it'd be good to see where that goes, because it does feel like the mountain bikes are right at the beginning in terms of that. And races are won by such small margins as well. Now, again, looking at the bikes used in the Worlds for the time trial, there's loads and loads of riders still on tubulars. And, you know, I don't know much about the triathlon world, but I'm assuming there's a lot less in the triathlon world. Do you think road racing teams are still stuck in the past a bit? Because, you know, tubulars, so many people have said for so long, they're quite an aero disadvantage. Do you think that teams are still making a big loss there?
Absolutely, definitely, yes. To make a very clear and decisive statement based on a lot of research and testing, tubular is dead. The tubular is worse aerodynamically, and it's worse in terms of rolling resistance. So, you know, it brings a tubular wheel setup is typically ever so slightly lighter, but, you know, the actual performance benefits as far as the stopwatch goes are negligible when you take that into account, comparing it to a good equivalent clincher or tubeless clincher setup. So, yes, the Pro Tour teams are massively in the past, and we work with Pro Tour teams as well, and we see this over and over again, that there's this reluctancy to move away from what they know. And I believe one of the main reasons for that is a lot of the director sportifs are former riders, and you know these guys are extremely experienced and have a lot of knowledge and when it comes to racecraft and strategy and so on, but they don't necessarily understand the physics, and you know that's not what they're trained to do. And to try and explain to them that a clincher is faster, and even if we put data on the table, doesn't always go over quite well, and takes them quite a way out of their comfort zone. So yeah, it's very interesting to see this reluctancy of the Pro Tour scene to embrace technology. And you know, when it comes to tubular, this is something that is just simply very easy to measure and to prove. But as you've mentioned, we are seeing more and more teams as well in the Pro Tour scene this year, particularly in time trial, using clinchers. And I think it's just a matter of time until the benefits that bring, you know, outweighs, let's say, potentially the only benefit of a tubular, which is the run on flat, benefit. But then again, yeah, our experience is, you know, when you look at the actual probability and how often you get a flat and the time lost due to that, you know, it doesn't make sense.
Well, as a mechanic, I get a little warm, fuzzy feeling when you say that. I mean, I certainly remember reading a book around about the year 2000 by one of the US postal mechanics talking about, you know, winning the Tour de France in bloody years, as we know now. And he was like, he said, look, no Pro Tour team's ever going to be on clinchers. Of course, tubeless wasn't a thing then, but for road bikes. And it is nice to see, you know, teams like Quickstep just even riding in a tube, never mind tubeless, for these benefits. So one of the things that's been somewhat controversial, and there's been a lot of chat about it in the last few months, has been the bike that Team GB used at the Olympics. Incredibly radical looking bike, launched to great fanfare. And then there's been a bit of kerfuffle that actually it was a design that was out there already. So what did you think of the bike, and what do you think to the story around it?
First of all, I really loved to see the bike. Because I saw that, I think the bike has got some good merits as a track bike in terms of we can dig into a few details of why it's good. But what's funny is, you know, with the work we do designing bikes for many brands, it's our job to understand what patents are out there, what restrictions there are, and it's quite interesting because we came across the original patent for that bike design a number of years ago. And it was, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. And, you know, we understood exactly what they were trying to achieve with that design. And we thought, oh, that's kind of clever. And, you know, we did some tests and designed some prototypes as well ourselves based on those kind of ideas. But yeah, when the Hope Lotus bike came out, my initial thought was, oh, okay, well, they've done a deal with regards to the intellectual property, the IP of that bike. And, you know, cool, because, you know, if I look at the original patent application and then I look at that bike, for me, it's just the same bike, just, you know, refined in some respects, or, you know, further developed or whatever. So, you know, my initial thought was, oh, there was a collaboration there. And then, you know, in hindsight, you know, I've read that there's a bit of a controversy surrounding that design. So, and I can completely understand why there's a controversy, but, you know, of course, as always, and it's also one of my pet hates about the cycling industry and about this whole world of IP and design protection, is it all boils down to formalities of who registered what in which country and all of this crap. Whereas, you know, this is clearly, for me, a design that has been on the market, or let's say has been patented in the past. So I would say isn't something new.
Wow. Well, that certainly is quite something, isn't it? So we'll see what happens in terms of the legals there. So not to spring this on you, because it's quite a big topic, but it just kind of, you know, when I was writing the document earlier today, I totally forgot I really wanted to talk to you about this. We've, here at Cycle Systems, been a bit mental, just like everyone at the moment, I think. And I was listening to our friends from Cycling Tips on their podcast recently, and they did a great show with someone from another wheel manufacturer talking about the ISO tubeless standards, which have come out of the ETRO tubeless standards for road bikes. Because, you know, you can spend £10,000 on your bespoke road bike and the tyre can blow off the rim as you're riding down the road, because there just hasn't been any sort of standardisation of rim design and tyre design. And this does seem pretty bizarre, and it's quite frustrating as an industry professional not to know what to recommend to people. So first of all, you know, at Swisside, have you been involved with ETRO and ISO with these tubeless standards, because all of your wheels are tubeless ready? And what, you know, are you able to say, well, these are the tires which will safely work on our wheels, or is that something that's out of your purview?
No, directly involved, no, but indirectly involved, yes. So we have the benefit, as a lot of people know, of a great relationship together with BT Swiss, who manufacture the wheels for Swisside. And DT Swiss is as now the leading manufacturer of high quality wheels in the cycling industry, is obviously heavily involved at the very top level in these kind of discussions. And first of all, it is so important, like you say, that there is a common standard that is used by both wheel manufacturers and tire manufacturers to lead to easy to use, easy to mount, and safe functioning wheel tire combination. And yes, we really need a common standard. And let's say there is a common standard. You know, the ETRFTO has been further improved in recent years. And the ISO standard is more or less very similar to that. And in the end, the only real difference is the ISO standard is a worldwide standard, whereas the ETRTO, I always get I can never pronounce it correctly, is effectively a European standard only. So, you know, if I had to lean one way or the other, I'd say the ISO standard is the way to go. Mm-hmm. But one thing which is a new topic when it comes to these standards is this whole discussion about hookless tires and tubeless, hookless, and so on. And this is an area where I have a strong opinion, because it's purely and simply a safety issue. And I have a big beef, if I may say so directly, with a certain big brand, which is pushing that, hookless is great, and this is, you know, you want to ride wider, and it gives you lower rolling resistance with, you know, like massive, rolling resistance savings, which are completely invalid and not true. without telling you that you actually then can't ride narrower tires anymore, and not being clear about what you can and can't ride.
Mm.
Now, to be really clear, if you want to run a hookless setup, you have to be running effectively at least 28 millimeter or wider tire. Secondly, you can't run that tire more than about 4.5 bar without being in danger of it popping off. Now, if you are a performance-oriented cyclist, running a 28C tire at 4.5 or 5 bar is not the optimum for both aerodynamics or rolling resistance.
Mm.
The only exception is if you're hammering over some cobbles in Roubaix, but this is a completely different kettle of fish. So the truth of the matter, and I want to be really clear about this to all the listeners, if you are interested in road cycling on roads, sometimes rougher roads as well, and you're interested in maximizing your aerodynamic performance and minimizing your rolling resistance and going fast, and that's your target, not necessarily comfort. So, you know, you're racing.
Mm.
Then what you want to be riding is probably a 25C tire at around about 6.5 up to 8 bar pressure, depending on your weight. Anything less is absolute pure lies and is actually quite simply dangerous, because you're getting these cases where people, it's not clear for people, and people are buying these hookless 24, 25 millimeter wide rims, and they're saying, oh, this is brilliant, I'm going to pop a 25C tire on this, and I'm going to pump it up to 5 bar, and the thing is falling off the tire when they go into a corner, and they're landing on their face. And that is, I think, as a wheel producer in the market, safety first. We have to make sure that our, you know, we're producing quality products that, you know, in the end, the customers are buying our products to have fun and be safe and be fit out on the road. And first and foremost, we need to make sure that that's possible with the products we sell. And we need to be clear about the limitations of those products. So to wrap up my beef monologue on this topic, the ISA standards really need to now address this topic of hookless rims and make it clear what's allowed and what's not.
I think so, definitely. And like I said, if you know, someone's going to be getting a set of Hadron squared wheels, can you say to them it will run any road tubeless tire on the market, or is there a list of recommended tires?
You can ride on Swiss side wheels, which have a hook, which is all of the Swiss side wheels currently on the market. You can ride any tire you want on those. Where we still have a little bit of a problem is that, say, some tires are more difficult to mount than others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the Continental GP 5000 TL, so the tubeless Conti, has such a stiff sidewall, it is really a problem to mount for a lot of people. I can get them on, and I also understand that the wheels are actually very robust, so you can use quite a lot of brute force to mount it, but, you know, it's not the old days where you can just, you know, use your hands and they just flop on, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So you do get this, you know, some Schwalbers and some Vittoria mounts, super loose and easy. The Contis, on the other hand, are super tight. This does need to be addressed. And, you know, you do get one of the challenges we've seen, particularly with the Conti tire, is the tubeless tire, the bead is so tight that when you finally get it on, when you pump it up and the bead pops onto the ceiling lip of the rim itself, and it does that by the air pressure pushing it outwards, the actual compression that's created by the bead being actually slightly too small than what it needs to be is so large that it actually compresses the wheel more than the maximum tire pressure would normally.
Mm.
And it's leading to issues where, for example, on the rear wheel, if anyone's ever had a really good look at their rear wheel when they pump the tire up, you'll actually see the dish move slightly.
Mm.
That's because of the asymmetric spoke tensions that you get. And as you compress the rim, you actually get a lateral movement as the spoke tensions find their new balance. And one of the problems is that with these tubeless tires, when you pump them up really strongly and the bead pops on, the compression is like as though you had that tire pumped up to 10 bar. And you end up with sort of strange issues and larger spoke detensioning than would be anticipated. So there are some issues here that I think still need to be addressed.
Well, that's really fascinating as a mechanic, because obviously, when we're building up crazy super light wheels, As soon as you put a tire on, an inflator tire on there, you really see the spokes detension and you've got to retension the spokes up. But we've never really thought about it for big, you know, sort of 60, 90 mil type rims. So that's incredible that that's happening to those big chunks of carbon.
Yeah, absolutely. And even like to talk about the very, very biggest chunk of carbon, you see with the disc, the full disc rear wheels, this can be even more pronounced.
Wow.
So, you know, there are cases where people are dividing wheels or even dishing wheels deliberately offset, let's say, 1 to 2 millimeters in the dish in a static, without a tire mounted.
Mm.
But when they mount a tire, particularly a tubeless tire, and pump it up, that actually moves into the center. And with certain bikes, and Cervelos are bikes in particular where you get very little tire clearance, sometimes it's actually necessary.
Well, that's really funny because one of the videos I was finishing off today for Cycle Systems Online was all about measuring spoke tension and showing people how to do that. So you've got the advanced lesson all teed up for me there, John Paul.
asymmetric spoking of rear wheel. Yeah.
Brilliant. We'll put that into our level 3 course. So essentially, that's everything I wanted to ask you, but I am really keen, you know, to give you the chance to tell people about what Swisside has got. So basically, if someone's listening to this podcast and going, wow, I'm after a new set of wheels or I'm interested in aero optimization, where can people find you and what can they get?
Yeah, I mean, best place to go is to our website, which is swisside.com, spelled with 3 S's in the middle, Swisside, all one word. Yeah, there we have a lot of resources. You can, of course, see all of the wheels that we produce. And, you know, we produce our focus is aerodynamic wheels. But we also have some good training wheels in there as well. And we also have a lot of resources. So take a look at our aero tips, for example. We like to debunk a lot of myths and try and make aerodynamics understandable for everyone. So you'll see, most recently we've published some things about disc brake size. You know, does your disc rotor size matter? The answer is no, but take a look at those sorts of videos that we publish online. So you can see all our products and you can see an overview of the type of aerodynamic development work that we're also doing for partners. Lots of good stuff to read there at swisside.com.
Well, that's good to know. So for people who are ordering their new group sets, you may have to wait till 2024 to get it. But at least, you know, you can order yourself some 160 rotors and not compromise the aerodynamics. So John Paul Ballard from Swisside, thanks so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed watching your educational videos on the Swisside YouTube channel. If you've not seen these guys, they're really in depth, you know, so from a few minutes up to an over an hour for people like me that like to really dive into it. So definitely get into all of those resources. I'm sure you'll be able to make yourself faster one way or another. And any mountain bikers that are listening, maybe you can steal something on the competition by speaking to JP. So thanks so much for joining us, John Paul.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Sean. And thanks to everyone listening. Hopefully you've had a little bit of an insight into the real aerodynamics in cycling. And you've been able to learn a little bit more, which is our goal in the end.
Right, and we'll get the rap battle set up with that wheel manufacturer as well.
Okay.